From now on, unlike your parents were, you are the secret force of Retro Asylum.
They're playing so fast, they're the only ones who can take you back in time. They play old games, they're more retro than J1 Optimus Prime. At home or the arcade for adventures in a fantasy zone. Pretty soon they'll be off on a mission. Come and hear them go.
Retro Asylum.
What's behind this podcast show?
Hello and welcome to episode 118 of Retro Asylum. Now for today's episode we have myself, Paul Driscoll, aka The Drisk, and a good friend of mine, Alex Mort, who hosts my favourite podcast, well outside of Retro Asylum of course, the Retro Game Squad. So how are you doing, Alex?
Good, Paul. How about yourself?
Yeah, not bad, really. We've been just lots of retro stuff going on and life catching up with me.
But I know the feeling. It's all good. I'm right there with you.
So anyway, well, today what we thought we would do is mix things up a little. We are going to cover the Nintendo Entertainment System, but rather than cover lots of games on the consoles like we normally do, we thought we'd mix things up a little bit and do just 10 of Alex's favourite games that he'd played growing up. And Alex is perfectly placed for this because he has, well, you literally lived and breathed Nintendo throughout your childhood, didn't you?
Absolutely.
Alex?
I got my NES probably in, I want to say 86 or 87. I was probably 12 or 13 at the time.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the first device I had that played games. It was the first console I ever had. And the memories I have with the NES, I'll always cherish. It's one of my favorite systems of all time. Just countless hours playing these 10 games and many, many more, of course. But I had so much fun with these 10 games that when you'd approached me, Paul, about being on the show, and thank you, by the way, for having me on. It's been looking
it's
forward to it.
It's great to have you. Yeah, I've been looking forward to it as well.
Yeah, it's these 10 games to me are just epitomized some of the best memories I had of gaming in my childhood, and I'm happy to share them with you.
No, that's great. And because, I mean, the remit that we had with this is I said to Alex, whatever games are your favorites, but outside of the ones that everyone always goes to with the Nintendo, so your Marios, your Zeldas, your Metroids, because they've all been covered so many times by so many podcasts out there that, you know, we just wanted other games outside of that remit. So there's a great choice of games that Alex has chosen, and I've been having amazing fun playing through them. So I can't wait to share it with you all.
Yeah, and you know, some of these games were released over in Europe, and of course, being a North American podcast, I think the perspectives can be a little bit different because there are a few games on this list that didn't see a European release. So while your listeners might be familiar with them, hopefully this will give them a little more information about those games that didn't get a European release that really are fun and fantastic games.
Yes, absolutely. But before we get into it all, Alex, let's just talk about some of the retro stuff that we've been getting up to lately.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I always am, of course, doing our own retro gaming podcast. And so this month's episode that we're working on, the theme of the episode is going to be games with female protagonists. And I'm just about done. I only have about 2 games left. So far, I've played through Tomb Raider, and that's been a lot of fun because I never played the original on the either the PlayStation or the Saturn. I was playing through the Saturn version. That's a lot of fun.
Wow, you never played the original?
Never played the original, no. In fact, I've never played any of them,
wow,
to be honest with you.
That's amazing. That's one of the go-to games on like the PlayStation and even the Saturn, really.
Yeah, it is. And I kind of am a little bummed out I skipped it over back in the day, because playing it now, it's very easy to see how groundbreaking that game really was. The sense of exploration, the different style of platforming, grabbing onto ledges, jumping from platform to platform. It's a lot of stuff we take for granted now, but at the time, it was pretty groundbreaking.
Yeah, I remember the first time I ever saw Tomb Raider was actually on the PC. Because I was more with PCs, because I think it was on a PC computing course. And just saw someone showing me this game, Tomb Raider, and it was one of the few times where it didn't matter that I couldn't really afford it. I just went straight to the shop, bought it, you know, brand new, full price, didn't care, and went straight home and sort of played it. It really did blow me away that much.
It's sort of funny how when you're in your 20s, for example, you don't necessarily give that much of a thought to credit and budgeting and things like that. But, you know, we managed to get by. We're here. We're alive. You know, everything's good. But I know what you mean. There are certain games that came out that I just had to, I don't know how I found the way, scrounging through change in the cushions of the couch or scraping some money together. I know what you mean, man.
So what other games have you been covering as well as Tomb Raider? You've been, what other female protagonists?
Yeah, we played Mischief Makers on the N64, and that is just a spectacular platformer with some of the best gameplay mechanics I've ever seen. This is another one. I've had the cartridge actually since the game was released. I only played through the first few stages, and I went a little past halfway through the games thus far, and the gameplay mechanics are just so creative and innovative, and the character is so charming and captivating. That one's been a blast to play. And I also got done playing Metroid 2, which is, of course, in my opinion, it's a top 10 game on the Game Boy. And another one I was playing was Shantae on the Game Boy Color. And, man, that game is a gem. What a fantastic game that is.
I look forward to sort of trying with all these. I mean, that's why one of the things I like when you do your podcast that's similar with this is that you get to try, you hear about games that you perhaps wouldn't normally play and then go out and play them and find, you know, they're real gems, real classics.
I couldn't agree more. The one of the best aspects of doing a retro gaming podcast is that it's forced me to play games that might ordinarily be outside of my comfort zone or something I may not have given a chance otherwise. And it's really been enlightening to play all these games I missed out on all these years because maybe I had a misconception about them, or maybe I just thought I wouldn't like it. But being, in a manner of speaking, forced to play these games, I've discovered some fantastic games I otherwise would have completely missed out on. And I think that's the awesome thing about podcasts and, you know, YouTube channels and all these different sort of outlets, is that if you're willing to listen, there's a whole breadth of information out there on things you may not have given a chance, but that are still fantastic just the same.
No, absolutely. I mean, this podcast itself is a good case in point, you know, because you gave me 10 NES games to cover, and, you know, some of them I had played before, but but not really given the time to learn the nuances and things. But, you know, spending the time with them, you really get to love the Nintendo console and the games that are on them. Because over here, it's probably difficult for people in America and Canada and places to appreciate. But over here, the Nintendo really wasn't a particular popular system. I mean, it sold half as well as the Master System here for consoles, to give you an idea.
Yeah, I've been doing a little research into the differences as far as the NES is concerned between North America and the European markets. And, you know, I've got a couple theories as to why maybe some of these things played out a little bit differently. And you're absolutely right. In North America, the NES was just a runaway freight train of success. The Master System was a far distant second place, which is, you know, in direct contrast to what was going on in Europe at the time. And I think some of maybe why that transpired is, you know, in North America, we did have some home computers that had a sort of a foothold as far as gaming is concerned, like the Apple II and the Commodore 64. But there was no runaway computer platform that was very successful, for example, like the ZX Spectrum or the Amiga.
Yeah.
And I think part of that kind of let consoles get a foothold in the home market in North America. In that, I think that trend really started as early back as the first Pong consoles in the Atari VCS or 2600. Those two sort of consoles somewhat established a pattern as consoles being the de facto way to play video games at home. And I think that mindset kind of resonated with a lot of gamers in the 70s and 80s. And I think it's also had a hand in the Nintendo Entertainment System being as successful as it was. From many people's perspective, and still to this day, consoles were just a lot simpler. You pop your cartridge in, turn the power on, press start or whichever, and you're ready to go. The other reason I think maybe the NES was such a runaway success here is because of Nintendo's, frankly, restrictive and borderline monopolizing licensing policies, which really starved the Master System for any third-party support,
yeah.
Especially in North America. The Master System had virtually no third-party support, and that's, again, because of Nintendo's restrictive policies dictating that publishers can release the same game on a competing platform. So I find it somewhat ironic that the last few home consoles Nintendo's had, they themselves have been starved of third-party support, which is something they were forcing upon Sega back in the day. I always thought that to be kind of funny.
It is. Revenge is best served cold, as they say.
Yes, indeed.
But, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, I think in the UK in particular, but also in Europe, just because there was the cheaper alternatives, and particularly with computers, I mean the Spectrum the UK
piracy
had
must have been rampant.
Piracy was rampant, but also, I mean, we had to give an idea what it was like because it was on tape a lot of the games.
Sure.
We had things like budget games, which were $1.99. You could literally buy a game for pocket money prices.
Sure, for the pack of a price of gum, almost.
Yeah, well, I think it's about $3, probably, to put it in US sure. dollars terms. And even better than that, we had video game magazines. In fact, this is probably what killed it for the Spectrum. Video game magazines got in sort of a war between themselves, where they were trying to outdo each other with free games they would give. So we reached a point there were like 7 free games on a single magazine. So you just never bought any, because why would you?
Sure, you were getting a whole bunch of games for free. Well, for the price of a magazine, that is.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, it was good. Although I do envy, I think because of that, and then I moved, obviously, to the Amiga, which, again, piracy was rampant.
Sure.
You never had, and I do envy this with sort of yourself and other Americans and what have you who had the consoles. You never really spent huge amounts of time with games often because you had so many. It was always sort of like you'd spend like perhaps a day with a game, and then there would always be others for you to try because you had all these games. Whether, of course, for yourself, I imagine it was a case that you would get a game for your birthday or a game for Christmas, and that was probably
exactly it.
For a long while.
Yeah. And the reason some of the games I have on this list we're about to discuss were actually, they're not the best games in the world, but in the example of one particular game we'll talk about, it was one of the only games I had for the better part of a year. I only had about, when I first got my NES, all I had was Super Mario Brothers for like a good 6 months. And then my mother comes home one day from visiting the States with like 3 games at once, and my brain just exploded, but I didn't get any more games for another 6 or 8 months or so. So it all depends, I suppose, on your economic situation, your age at the time. If you're a youngster, yes, you were only getting games, maybe for special occasions and such, but I would quite often go rent games. That was a pretty common thing to do back in the 80s and early 90s in both the US and Canada. So I got to rent a whole lot of games, and some of the games on this list are, that's actually how I first played them, was renting them over and over and over again, till eventually I got older and got a job and decided, I need to have this for myself, as opposed to renting it in perpetuity. So.
Oh, that's cool, yeah. I mean, for our listeners, actually, let's talk about, your gaming history so people understand sort of where
sure.
you're coming from. So, Was the Nintendo Entertainment System your first console, or did you have perhaps Atari or something beforehand?
Right. The NES was the first home console I ever had.
Yeah.
Prior to that, I had a Texas Instruments TI-99/4A computer.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking earlier about loading and saving games to tape. That's how I played most of my games on the TI-99/4A.
Yeah.
There was a cable, of course, you can attach to a tape deck, and the TI-99 actually did have a built-in cartridge slot. It was otherwise very similar to a Commodore 64, but that was my very first experience with gaming was with that Texas Instruments computer and playing with the Atari VCS at my cousin's house.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do oftentimes is the magazines we would get here would actually have games written in BASIC. And you can take the magazine home and just copy the lines of code into your computer and play the game.
Oh, yeah, see, good old type-ins.
Sure. Of course, the Texas Instruments version of BASIC always had the word call in front of every command. So instead of you print something, you'd always be call print or call clear instead of clear, for example.
Yeah.
But, you know, being born in the mid-70s, I kind of lucked out, in my view, as far as gaming is concerned, because I was there through the rise and then, the fall of arcades, and I got to see the earliest platforms all the way to where we are today. So I consider myself really lucky, but when I got my NES, that was when I fell head over heels in love with gaming. It's always been sort of a way of life for me. Gaming's always been a part of my life and always will be. But the NES, it just had so many cherished memories, and you'll notice on the list that a fair amount of the games we're going to talk about are action platformers or side-scrolling platformers, and that's because it's my favorite genre of gaming, and it's something the NES did particularly well. In fact, I don't think very many systems can come close to it as far as just side-scrolling action platformers. I don't think there are too many platforms that come close to the number and quality of games that the NES had.
Yeah, you're probably right there. I mean, Mega Drive's perhaps.
Yeah, I'd say the Genesis and Mega Drive are pretty far, pretty close to it.
Mm.
But it seems like certain systems are pretty well geared to certain types of games. For example, the Saturn was very good at shoot 'em ups and fighting games. The Super Nintendo was blessed with quite a few popular RPGs, as we all know. So I think the NES was pretty well suited to platformers, and it's my favorite genre to this day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can understand actually why so many of these games are rock hard, because if you've got 8 months
yes.
before your next game, you want it rock hard.
Yeah, I'm somewhat of a masochist. I do enjoy my platformers to be pretty challenging.
I'm not very good at video games, but I did my best with this. I got surprised further than I thought with a lot of them, really.
As long as you try and you're having a good time, that's what it's all about, man. It's not about that's the whole. I think a lot of people sometimes lose the point. The whole point of video games is to have fun.
Yes, yeah.
So if you're playing even if you're playing a competitive fighting game, and as long as you don't take it too seriously, we're talking about video games here. And I think that sometimes even I lose sight of that. It's as long as I'm having fun, do I really care if I win or lose? I mean, as long as I walk away with a smile on my face and entertain, hey man, that's what it's all about.
No, I completely agree with you there. I mean, that's one of the reasons I like retro gaming, really, is because it takes it in its purest form. A lot of these
absolutely
latest games, they're all sort of trying to recreate films and make you cry and
yeah, there's something to be said about simple fun and easy to pick up. And one aspect I really enjoy of retro gaming is if I only have 15-20 minutes, that's plenty of time to get a enjoyable gaming session in. I could just, we'd mentioned earlier, just pop the cartridge in, play to your heart's content, whether that's 15 minutes or, 4, 5, 6 hours, playing overnight. That's the beauty of retro gaming. And I enjoy modern gaming as well, but the retro gaming will always have a special place in my heart because, again, it was a formative part of my childhood and teenage years and even in my early 20s. So it'll always hold a special place in my heart.
So, because I don't know quite how old you are, when did you get the NES?
I'm quickly approaching 40. Oh,
yeah, same as me. So you're the same age as me.
I'm very, very close to 40.
I've just turned 38, so I was... So you...
Well, happy belated birthday.
Yes. depressing, isn't it, as you come fast towards 40. Yeah, so how old were you when you got your NES console then?
I was about 12 or 13. I want to say closer to 12.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you, it's the single best Christmas present I've ever received in my life.
Yeah.
My head just exploded when I unwrapped that NES. And it wasn't the action set. It just came with Super Mario Brothers. But that was perfectly fine with me.
Definitely, yeah.
At the time, all I had was a 13-inch black and white television. And for years, that's what I played my NES games on, was playing them in black and white, and I was grateful for it. It didn't bother me one bit that I was playing them, you know, in black and white. And just so many games, playing them early on, going in, trading cartridges with your friends at school, and renting games, and, you know, picking up the latest issue of Nintendo Power, reading up on all these things that are coming out, and just the joy of going to the rental store and seeing, you know, holy crap, there's a Ninja Gaiden 2. What? You know, your brain explodes because, you know, we didn't know, you know, when release dates were or what games were coming out. You just go to the store or the rental store, and there it was staring you in the face.
Yeah, no, I can imagine.
So I kind of missed that a little bit, too, you know, just the surprise and the mystery of it.
No, I completely get where you're coming from there. I mean, it was similar for us. Unless you were getting the magazines all the time, you usually didn't know with all
right.
the games. And you just see it on the shelf and your little head would explode with excitement as you rush to save up and buy it.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Jeff Minter, and you're not listening to one of my sheep. You're listening to Retro Asylum.
Are you into modern gaming as well as retro? Are you in a job where you can get away with being on the internet all day? Or perhaps you are unemployed? Perhaps you laugh if you see people trip up? If so, then the Rollmuck forums are for you. That's RLLMUKforum.com.
We'd like to thank our main site sponsors, PlayExpo.net, for all the latest news on Play Margate. Keep an eye on their website, Funstock.co.uk, loads of excellent gift ideas here from the Neo Geo X, JXD Android Gaming Tablet and much more. Get 5% off your order using the discount code ASYLUM at checkout. And also RetroTowers.co.uk, the only place to pick up the fantastic EverDrive and retro console cables and peripherals. For 5% off your order, please use the discount code RetroAsylum at checkout. And we'd especially like to thank our June site sponsors for people who've donated to the upkeep and running of the website. Nicholas Lees, Darren Tungate, John McManus, Michael Keith, RetroTowers.co.uk and RetroMash.com. If you'd like to sponsor the show, please visit our website at RetroAsylum.com and click the donate button at the bottom of our homepage. Everything pledged goes straight back into maintaining the site, so if you like what you hear, please consider donating.
Nintendo Entertainment System,
the one to play with Rob, the extraordinary video robot, batteries not included. He helps you tackle even the toughest challenge. Will you be the first to raise the incredibly accurate Zapper and play games like Duck Hunt or action-packed Hogan's Alley and high-flying Kung Fu, each sold separately? Will you be the one to experience the Nintendo Entertainment System? Comes with Rob, Zapper, Control Deck, two controllers, Gyromite, and Duck Hunt.
Well, what I thought I'd do, before we go into the actual games themselves, I thought I'd just do a really quick history of Nintendo, because I think it's important to understand where they came from and how they evolved, you know, to the NES console.
Sure.
So Nintendo sort of started out way back in 1889, if you can believe it, in the eastern part of Kyoto by Fujisaro Yamauchi, and I'm probably massacred his name there, but they started off making Hanafuda cards, which are sort of like Japanese type of playing cards.
Trading or playing cards.
Or playing cards. And it was called the Nintendo Hanafuda Playing Cards was the full title, and Nintendo, the rough translation is sort of leave luck to heaven, which I think is a lovely sort of phrase, really.
Actually, it is. Yeah, it's quite elegant.
It is, yeah. And then, you know, I mean, they carried on pretty much like that, and then we get all the way to 1949 when the grandson of Fujisaro or Yamuchi, Hiroshi Yamuchi, takes over the business as third president. And he's like austere, ruthless, gets rid of all sort of competition when he goes in there. But he's sort of very keen to take Nintendo in a completely new direction. So in 1956, he starts doing a deal with Disney to do westernized playing cards, and at this time he also drops the Hanafuda part of the title, so it's just Nintendo at this point in 1956. And you know, Nintendo start to have a huge success with that. They then try everything they can. They try instant rice, taxi firms, even did a love hotel, which,
oh boy, yeah.
Which let's just say you could rent it by the hour for the, yes, budding adulterer.
Oh yeah.
And of course,
gotta get your boom chicka boom.
Yeah,
on.
Absolutely. And apparently, and I don't want to get sued by Nintendo, but in David Sheff's book about Nintendo called Game Over, apparently Hiroshi was the one of the best customers, shall we say, of the Love Hotel.
Oh, that's awesome.
So,
that's,
you know, there's awesome. A family company, Nintendo, that we all love, doing love hotels. But there we go. So moving on to 1969, you know, they...
I did not know they had such a sordid past.
I know. Well, most companies do, I think. That's the thing.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, moving on to 1969, that's when they started moving in the 70s towards toys. And that was largely because of... literally, I mean, Hiroshi could recognize talent, I think, and there was just somebody on his production line called Gunpei Yokoi, which, of course, many of us will know the name now.
Of course, yeah.
And he was just literally sort of showing toys that he made in as a hobby in his spare time to, like, fellow workers. And Yamuchi sort of, like, was saying, I think that's going to be the direction that we're going to go for now. So, you know, that was the point that Nintendo started going into toys for the first time, doing, like, Love Tester toys and Extender Hands. And they also did Pong clones as well, where they would sort of mm-hmm. do the home Pong clones that were so... because nobody cared about copyright, really, back then.
Sure, of course not.
Yeah, so then you go into the 80s, and Nintendo makes another breakthrough with the Game & Watch, which, for those who don't know, it was like a portable LCD display with a very simple game.
Yeah, and some of the Game & Watch designs were a clamshell design, which, you know, later on inspired the Nintendo DS's design.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I think Oil Panic was the first one that did the clamshell. Mm-hmm. But not only that, of course, Donkey Kong in 1982 that they did, the Game & Watch, that was the first time that they did the D-pad and the two buttons, A and B. So,
yes.
So I mean, it's such an important thing with the Game & Watch, really, that, you know, for Nintendo's history, really.
Absolutely. It laid some of the groundwork for their hardware. And not only that, Gunpei Yokoi was such a... he was just such a revolutionary mind, and I think his importance at Nintendo cannot be overstated enough. He really broke through some great ideas, and of course, he was the one that designed the Game Boy,
yes,
and
yeah.
went on to later design the WonderSwan. But his contributions to Nintendo were just tremendous.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think he made a slight misstep with the Virtual Boy, but at least it was always out-of-the-box thinking, wasn't it? That's what you can
yeah,
say.
Yeah, and in order to innovate, you've got to think, you know, outside of convention. So one misstep being the Virtual Boy in really a sea of success. There's no reason, it's a shame he was, you know, taken from us so soon, but I don't think it tarnishes his career in
no,
the least.
No, not at all. No, I mean, you're right, it's so sad. He died of a car accident, didn't he, I believe.
That's right, yeah.
And this highlights why it's so important, covering all of this, and I wish more developers would sort of spend the time covering their...
To archive the, you know, the creation process.
Exactly, I mean...
Right.
There's a case and example, you know, and I could give countless others that have been... visionaries that have been lost to us that very little has been sort of catalogued, really, which is so sad.
Sure.
Yeah, so I mean, moving on, you had then, of course, in the early 80s, Nintendo of America gets set up as well, run by Minoru Arakawa, who's the son-in-law of Hiroshi. Then there's that famous story that I think many know, which is they almost bankrupt themselves over buying on a new game called Radar Scope in the arcades.
Yes, but they took lemons and they made quite a bit of lemonade out of it.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So they literally come up with the idea, because Well, with Radarscope, it's not a bad little shooter, really. But the trouble is, by the time that they decide they're going to come out with this Radarscope and they actually get the cabinets, a certain game called Pac-Man comes along, and nobody's suddenly interested in shooting games anymore. You know, that's old hat. Everybody wants character-based games. So, as you say, they got all these lemons of these arcade cabinets that they can't sell, and they hit on the idea that if they just change the ROM, change the actual game itself, but use all the cabinets and just change the artwork, and away they go. And this is one that I'm sure everybody knows, which is that Nintendo didn't really have anybody spare. They've got this creative guy that did artwork called Shigeru Miyamoto, and sort of encouraged him to work with creating a new game that would replace. And of course that game was Donkey Kong, which I think is safe to say that was the real point. And although Game & Watch was a huge success, etc., that was a real point when Nintendo really went into being a major video game player in the industry.
Yeah, you know, Nintendo actually pretty prolific in the early days in arcades in the 80s. I think later on, as you know, the NES came out, they focused a little bit more on the home consoles and sort of left the arcade industry to other companies. But early on, they really had some fantastic arcade games. Donkey Kong, Mario Brothers, Punch-Out, you know, the list goes on and on. They really did have some fantastic arcade games back in the day.
Oh, absolutely. So anyway, so they're armed with this success. So they then decide they're going to come out with a computer, and they decided that Family Computer would be a good name, calling it Famicom for short. They had like an electronics guru in there called Masayuki Umera, who had sort of been brought in to do sort of electronics and head up the R&D2 division within Nintendo. And he was given that impossible brief to create a game for only 9,800 yen, about £50, but also being the best game console out there. So it's like a crazy sort of brief
task.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of person that, you know, Yamauchi was. He just, you're going to do this. You know, Masayuki, he first of all did the very sensible thing, and it's amazing that others in, you know, competitor companies didn't do a similar thing. He went first to the arcade division and looked what's really important within making a game, and he realized very quickly that, see, the current way of thinking was you'd have a really as powerful processing chip, CPU, as you possibly could buy for the money. That was the general thinking. Whether he realized that no, that wasn't the way to go. You buy a real cheap CPU because you don't actually need to do that much processing, and you use that money to have a dedicated chip to do the graphics. And you know, that's the way that pretty much everything is done nowadays, that idea of a two chip system, you know, having a dedicated chip. Mm-hmm. But back then that was quite a novel sort of concept, and is kudos to his sort of genius, really, that he came up with that concept to follow. Because the actual chip is, I think it was used in the Atari 2600, you know, one of the cheaper, when it was, you know, switched to like the Junior, I think that was the chip that they using in essence in the Nintendo. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, so, you know, it's not a very powerful processing chip, but of course you had wonderful graphics chips sort of displaying, you know, the wonderful things that the Nintendo could do.
Sure, at the time I was blown away, you know, coming off the Texas Instruments computer and the Atari 2600, by comparison the NES looked like a cartoon, you know.
No, absolutely. I mean, I was same as you, really. If we had seen the Nintendo in Europe earlier, because that's one of the things, actually, just going with, you know, why it wasn't a success. By the time Nintendo even looked at Europe, I think it was 1987, and they didn't really market it very well. You know, if we'd seen it when, I think America saw it in 1986.
Sure, yeah.
Or 1985, actually, I think. So, you know, I mean, you had a good 2 years, and that would have really sort of blown away. It still impressed me today. The games that you've sort of chosen absolutely blew me away with the graphics that this little console can produce.
I'm always impressed towards the end of a system's life cycle when, for example, its successor has just been introduced. That's often when you get some of the most technically impressive games on a platform.
Yes, absolutely. Because they've learned the nuances, haven't they, with the system, and they know every trick in the book that they can,
yeah,
they can do.
And due to that sort of time frame, sometimes a lot of those games get overlooked because everybody's all excited about these newer platforms that are coming out. Well, in the meantime, these fantastically impressive games are sort of quietly being released, and there were so many games that came out, the great, fantastic games on the NES that came out in like 91, 92, and some of them, again, they got overlooked, and, you know, that's why I made sure that I got a few games from that sort of time frame on the list as well.
Yeah, and that's really good with that. So anyway, yeah, just to quickly go through the last bits, really. So Nintendo, they release it in Japan in 1983. They sell it for 14,800 yen, which is a lot more than Yamuchi's initial brief, but still an awful lot cheaper than what was out there. And one of the things that was, to get even that price, one of the things Nintendo had to do, they had to guarantee buying 3 million chips with the company selling the chips. So that was a huge risk. They really were.
Yeah, that's a big gamble.
Real gamble.
3 million units, even in today's market, that's a pretty sizable amount.
And even more impressive than this, and I wish the new sort of gaming companies, Microsoft and Sony, would take a leaf out of Nintendo's book. Because in Japan, in 6 months, it was a huge success. You know, they had games like Donkey Kong and Donkey Kong Jr. and Popeye, all great NES ports of popular arcade games. And so in 6 months' time, they've already sold 500,000 consoles. But reports were constantly coming back that the console was dying and obviously being taken back and replaced. And Hiroshi made the decision, because of the issue, knowing it was in quite a percentage of them, he actually recalled all the unsold Famicoms in Japan. Regardless if, you know, Nintendo lost a lot of money with it. They missed summer holiday sales and various things. But, you know, Hiroshi said it was nothing to the cost of Nintendo's reputation if they, like, let those consoles remain, you know, where people would have had the disappointment.
Yeah, it's not only a smart business move, but it's also the more proper and honorable thing to do. If you have a product out there that you know is malfunctioning, it needs to be addressed. Now, I wish they'd taken that same stance when they redesigned the NES for the North American and European markets, because, as we all know, that 72-pin connector is notorious for dying out.
Yes. Well, we'll just wrap up very quickly. So it gets released in America. They start off in actually doing various things. They tried the AVS, which was sort of, they tried to turn it into a keyboard. Not because at this point in America had suffered a massive crash, didn't they? Video game crash.
Sort of, yeah, it was pretty bad.
See, this is fascinating, actually, just to go slightly on a tangent, because over here we didn't really notice that bigger crash, because, of course, we were all with video, computers rather than consoles.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, part of the how Nintendo got around that perception, because, of course, it was the Atari 2600, really, or the VCS, that was sort of at the epicenter of the video game crash. Mm. And the public's opinion was that video game consoles are junk.
Yeah.
So Nintendo's strategy in North America was to market it as a toy.
Yes, yeah.
As opposed to a video game platform. And that's why they actually licensed Mattel to distribute it. I know they did that in Canada for certain. I want to say at first they were doing the same in the U.S. with Mattel as well. Because Mattel was a very known toy manufacturer. And that was how they got the NES into people's homes, is by using the Mattel brand to market it as a toy as opposed to a video game console, to avoid the stigma of the crash that had just passed.
That's it. And they tried various things. They tried to make the console look like a toy. That's why they went for that sort of boxy design, wasn't it?
Very, very, very ingenious on their part, actually.
Yeah, it seemed to work. And you also, they did front loading, so it felt more like a VCR. And of course, they gave it the name the Entertainment System, just sure. Never using the words, you know, video game or any way to sort of avoid it using that word.
It's a big play on words.
But and of course, one of the things that they came out with two packs, as I think you hit on before. One was the deluxe set, which was $299, and that included an ROB robot, which is I think it was a robot operated buddy, isn't it? I think that's what.
Yeah, robotic operating buddy. That's right.
And also it also came with a zapper gun as well, with Duck Hunt. Mm-hmm. So that was good sort of fun. And then they also came out with a control deck version, which was $200, so a good $100 cheaper, and that just came with one game, and two control panels, pads, I believe.
Yeah, but, that's the one I got as a kid.
Yeah, so but that game, of course, was Super Mario Brothers. So, so that, what a game to have packed in. Got to go as one of the best, isn't it?
Another smart choice.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, I think we covered about the history enough, really. But if anybody wants to know more, there is a fantastic book called Game Over by David Sheff. Now, it's really sad that it's out of print, but I've noticed in the archive area, it's been made available for free. So I'm going to give you, in the show notes, a link to that book, because it, for those interested in sort of video game history, it's essential reading. It's really good, and it's crazy that it's out of print and you can't buy it anywhere. I mean, I was lucky enough that I got it back in 1999, I think it was, with a video game magazine called Arcade Magazine. They gave this whole book free on the cover on one of the issues, which is...
And you weren't kidding me. We're pretty desperate.
Punch-Out. Nintendo has the most video game hits. Hogan's Alley, The Legend of Zelda, and more like Metroid, Rad Racer, and you can play them only on the Nintendo Entertainment System. Now you're playing with power.
Okay, so let's talk about the games themselves. So, Alex, I'll pass it on to yourself if you want to do the honors and go through the games that you chose.
Absolutely. So, our first contender is an absolute joy to play, and it is called Punch-Out. It was originally released as Mike Tyson's Punch-Out in 1987, and then it was rebranded, taking the Mike Tyson's license out of it, and then the last boss being replaced with Mr. Dream, and that version was released in 1990. Of course, it's a single-player game developed and published by Nintendo. You can also find it on the Wii 3DS and Wii U Virtual Console. And the reason this game is on this list is because I've yet to play many games that exude so much charm and personality as much as Punch-Out.
Yeah.
There's something about these the boxers you face, and obviously, as its name implies, it's a boxing game, and it's inspired by a Nintendo arcade game of the same name, but the character you fight against, they're just oozing charm and personality in their animation and their mannerisms, and, you know, there's dialogue in between rounds, and, you know, it's just hilarious when you're fighting Baron von Kaiser and you press start to throw an uppercut, yep. he flips out in a panic, and it's just hilarious. The mannerisms and the gestures of these the characters is just beyond anything I've ever played.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, sorry, carry on. Yeah, I mean, it's I'm so glad that you chose this one, because it was the case where I'd played Punch-Out a little, but not really spent time to learn the nuances, because it's a surprisingly deep game, isn't it, when you get into it, really. You know, the different controls, and it's quite tactical, because you...
It is.
Because you're losing hearts, isn't it, as you sort of... you know, if you keep on button mashing, you'll tire out.
Exactly. In, to me, Punch-Out is a game of pattern recognition and memorization and fast reflexes. That's the core of the gameplay of Punch-Out. You have to find the patterns and exploit the openings or weaknesses within the patterns you see the different boxers using.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just, you know, it's really smart gameplay, and it requires a lot of fast reflexes.
No, absolutely. And I mean, after I sort of played, you know, the NES version, I actually sort of thought, well, I'll have a look at the arcade version to sort of compare it against.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with the arcade version, and I think this is so clever with how they designed it, because in the arcade original, it was like a wireframe of the boxer, so you could see through and see the other boxer.
Right.
And they realized that they couldn't do that on the NES, because, you know, that's too much to do, like transparencies and what have you. So they actually made the main character as a little guy, so you'd only see so you wouldn't see very much, and you can see the whole of the enemy boxer, and he's a little guy, literally sort of taking on, you know, giant boxers.
It's a David versus Goliath story.
Absolutely.
It really is.
Yeah. But as you say, the characters are hilarious. I mean, it's. I don't know whether a lot of these sort of stereotypes could be could get away.
Yeah. So the game does skirt with some racial stereotypes. However, in fairness, nobody's spared, and I mean nobody.
No, absolutely.
So everybody got the short end of the stick on this one. That aside, it's just a well-crafted and charming game. And, you know, when I first saw the game, I was just shocked at how big the sprites were on the enemy boxers. They're huge, at least for an early NES game. And the amount of detail was just stunning. It's just so much fun to play. It's a simple game, but there's a good amount of depth and complexity to it. And, you know, doing speed runs through the game is a thing you can do. It's just so much fun.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad, as I say, you sort of chose this because it really sort of spent some time with it. Still couldn't get too far. I mean, I went through... So the first boxer you're against is called Glass Joe, isn't it?
Yes.
So he's quite easy, really. You just sort of learn the pattern that when he blocks his chest, you do the sort of... hit him along the jaw, isn't it? Do a high punch and vice versa. It took me a while to realise, you know, saying about the start key, because I was sort of like, ah, what are these stars? And then it was like...
right.
And then it was like, just, well, thankfully on the NES pad, there's not that many buttons, and it was like, ah, start for star. That makes sense.
Yep, and, that's your uppercut.
And uppercuts, and... yeah, that, and then the next thing was to understand that you had to sort of like replenish your energy and not just button mash, because that's when I first went for it. It was just like bash all the buttons, yeah. And then realizing I was running out of energy.
Yes, so regardless of whether you're playing the original Mike Tyson's version or the rebranded Punch-Out version, there are different circuits you go through. It's about three or four circuits you go through. And then the last fight is the only thing that's different. But even the fight itself is identical. Literally, all they did was reskin Mike Tyson's color skin tone and gave him a different face and called him Mr. Dream. You fight them identically. Mm. Their patterns are literally identical.
Okay. I didn't get anywhere near Mr. Dream. I managed to get through Von Kaiser, which, as you say, is funny when he goes sort of crazy.
Sure.
Bouncing around the screen, wasn't it, and things and that. And then there was Piston Honda, which was...
like I said, nobody spared.
Nobody spared, which is a very stereotypical Japanese fellow. Although I noticed actually on the arcade version, because he's one of the early fighters, it was a... I think he was called Piston Honda there, but it was a black guy on there. It sort of threw me a bit, really, that it was so different, you know, different character for the same name. Mm-hmm. And then you had Don Flamenco, wasn't it?
He's hilarious.
He comes in.
I love how if you beat him up after the first or second round, you find out he's actually wearing a toupee. It's hilarious. It's so clever.
It really is. And the way he comes skipping in with the rose in his mouth. I mean, yeah. Real stereotypical, obviously, taking the mick out of the Spanish. He's very Spanish.
Yeah, the Don Juan kind of thing.
I'll be honest, the far as I got, no matter how hard I tried, was King Hippo. I couldn't get past him. What do you do? Because whatever I was throwing at him, he seemed to block. And I think it was a timing thing, because I got a feeling I had to hit his belly button, but I wasn't quick enough.
Right. So what happens with King Hippo is there are times when if he just punches, just dodge. However, if he kind of shakes and opens his mouth briefly before he punches, you have to punch him in the face. Then you get to punch him in the stomach a bunch of times. You just repeat that a few times, and what happens is once you knock him down once, he's so big, he ain't getting back up.
So it's the case you just have to time it, and then he's out.
Yeah, just watch for him to shake and open his mouth as he's kind of bringing his fist back. That's when you punch him in the face, then go for the gut.
Yeah, no, this is definitely one that I really want to get back, you know, to play some more with. One of the things is, as you know yourself, Alex, it's sort of time conspires against you. So I didn't get as much time as I wanted to play with all of these games, partly because some of them I love so much that I played for days on end.
Yeah, I, believe me, I'm right there with you. And, you know, about Punch-Out, it's beyond it being one of my favorites on the NES, I really do feel objectively that it is one of the most classic and iconic games on the platform. Mm. And if you haven't played it, you really should. It's... you know, it's a couple notches below Super Mario Brothers and Zelda, of course, but it's one of those standout Nintendo titles for the NES. I don't think anybody should miss.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's definitely one that I'm going to go back to. And as you say, you just need to sort of spend time and learn the patterns, isn't it? With this game.
Yeah, you just got to study the patterns and find the weakness and go for it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, okay then, Alex, what's your next game?
So the next game is one of those three games I'd mentioned earlier that I got right a little bit after I got my NES, and it was one of the games I only had about four games for quite some time. Mm-hmm. And this game is Rampage. Mm-hmm. It was released in 1998. It was developed by Data East and published by Data East on the NES. It's a two-player game, and it's a port of a Midway arcade game of the same name. Now, what's interesting is Rampage did not see a release in Japan or Europe. This was a North America-only release on the NES. Yeah. And I've also played the Master System recently for Retro Game Squad. Mm-hmm. And I've got to say, the Master System version looks quite a bit better.
Yeah. Yeah, but, I think that's the thing. I was a bit spoiled with the Master System version.
Yes.
But you were saying, anyway, yeah.
The thing about the NES version is, despite its sort of inferior visuals, it captures the essence of the arcade game actually better than the Master System version does, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. It's the game, again, is full of a lot of little funny detail. And if you're not familiar with Rampage, it's a game where you actually get to be the bad guy for a change. You play the role of a person that's mutated into, like, a two-story tall monster. And you basically have to trash the United States from city to city, one building at a time. The game mostly comprises of you just climbing buildings and pummeling the buildings until they're rubble. But the fun part is what you find inside these buildings. And there's a whole huge buffet of things you can eat in this game. Some of them are good, some of them are bad. But, for example, you punch a hole in a wall, and you'll see a person in their bathtub. And then you can grab the person and eat the person. So there's just so much personality in this game. It's very charming. And, you know, you can eat people as food to regain your health. But there's also poisonous things you can eat as well if you're not careful. If you've played Rampage before, you know you're just constantly being attacked. There's just bullets everywhere. Everybody and their mother and their kids are shooting at you.
Yes, yeah.
But it controls fairly well on the NES. It actually controls very well on the NES, you know, but the one fault of Rampage, and it's regardless of whether you play the NES or the arcade or the Master System version, it's a fairly repetitive game. You're just pummeling buildings stage after stage after stage.
That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, it's great in the arcade for short bursts, isn't it? You put in your money and into the arcade and play it for a couple of minutes, whether... It does get quickly tiresome.
It does, especially if you're playing by yourself. Mm. The arcade version had three players simultaneous, and the NES and Master System versions only have two, and in fact, out of the three characters, only two of them are in the NES version. Its longevity is extended somewhat if you're playing with another person, of course, because you can beat each other up, and if you beat each other up to the point of making them revert back into human form, you can then eat them, which is awesome. What other form of humiliation could you lay upon your friend than just to do that to them?
Yeah, I mean, that was the first thing I realized is, oh, where's Ralph? Because three creatures, there's George, who's basically King Kong. Giant right. ape, Lizzie, which is basically Godzilla, and Ralph is a giant werewolf. And it sort of makes sense why if they're going to drop one of the characters, that's, you know, the giant werewolf.
The least iconic the least of the iconic. Three, I'd say.
Yeah, so, but, you know, I mean, I had a lot of fun with it, but it is, as you say, it's quite repetitive, and I suppose... I mean, back in the day, I grew up on the Spectrum version. Which does half a decent job. I mean, it's quite bright and sort of colourful and what have you. So, I mean, the NES version, I think, is probably better than that one. But certainly, I still think the Master System does a better portrayal for back in the day, personally. Of course, one of the nice things with the Spectrum is you always had a sort of computer control characters, so it was a good way to sort of play the game.
Oh, that's a little different.
Yeah.
Because in the Master System and NES version, if you're playing by yourself, you're playing by yourself. There's no computer controlled monster with you.
Yeah, so I mean, it was quite good. But one of the things that's interesting with the Spectrum version, there's a fascinating book by the guy who did that conversion, Bob Pape, and it's called it's a free book, actually. You can get it online, called It's Behind You. And it's fascinating reading this, because he goes through... He did...
It's a terrifying title for anything.
Well, it's quite a terrifying book, really, because you realise how he sort of got shafted. You have this vision, don't you, of game developers, and think, oh, you know, they're all driving Ferraris and things. And particularly with Bob Pape, because he did Rampage and R-Type on the Spectrum. Both, particularly the R-Type on the Spectrum, very highly regarded, brilliant version. But he literally sort of just got a job. He was, you know, in Wales and gets offered this job, goes for it, has very little experience, sort of turns up and they're like, right, okay, you're doing Rampage. No sort of like, you know, games that he'd written before or anything, you know, very little experience, and he's just told to write this game. And even crazier, and I wonder if it was the same for the Data East, there was, for a long, long time, there was no help with the Rampage. So they actually had to go to the arcade with a bucket of 10p's.
just to get the feel of the game, right?
Because
they didn't have access to any of the ROMs or the development tools. That's actually pretty... a common occurrence that, you know, in my research over the past few years, that's a pretty common thing that happened when developers were trying to port an arcade game to a home platform. It's kind of crazy to think that they had to recreate the feel of the game by hand. That's extraordinarily difficult to do.
Very, very talented. I mean, the way that he says he got around it, because originally he was trying to sketch out, and then realized that wasn't going to work. They couldn't even afford like a video camera or anything useful like that. So he actually had a dictaphone, the tape recorder, and so he would leave it recording, and he would describe what he was seeing on the screen from a programming point of view, particularly, but also what was there, and he just would record everything he was seeing as he was playing through, and they, you know, had to get very good with the game in the arcade. But it's
wow, that's pretty wild.
It is, and you know, it's the end result. I mean, the Spectrum's version's not particularly well renowned, but it, you know, considering what he was up against, that was quite impressive. Just shows you that how the gaming industry has changed.
Dedicated to their
really.
Craft, they were.
Yeah, but particularly as it was with no experience as well. It just walked straight in, and you're sort of doing all of this. But sorry, I'm going on a bit of a tangent there. But yeah, the NES version, I did enjoy, but I always have that fundamental problem with Rampage that it's gets tiresome quite quickly. It's sort of good in a short burst. It's great as a multiplayer.
Exactly. Yep.
But yeah, it was quite... I mean, for those who... The best legal way of playing Rampage is to get the Midway Arcade Treasures compilation on the PS2, Xbox, or PC. You can pick it up for a couple of quid, and that's got Rampage. And I think they often put it on some of the sequels. They've put it as a freebie game. So there's plenty of ways to sort of play the arcade version. But yeah, no, I can see as a kid, you're absolutely adoring this, because it's destroying a village. You get to play King Kong or the lizard. Did you which was your favourite character? I always went for George myself.
Always Lizzie.
You always went the Godzilla route.
Absolutely.
Then.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's another great choice there. So what's your next game then, Alex?
So the next game is probably one of the most hectic and enjoyable kind of competitive two-player games on the NES, and it's Super Dodgeball. It was released in 1989. It was developed by Technos Japan and published by Sony ImageSoft. It's a two-player simultaneous game. It's also available on the Wii Virtual Console. And in Japan, this game is known as Neketsu Kuku, Dodgeball Boo. And this game is part of the Kunio-kun series, which started with Renegades.
Yes.
Excuse me. And the thing about Super Dodgeball is, on the surface, it seems very simple, and it's a very it's a game that's very simple to pick up and play. But the gameplay is actually a little more deep than you might expect. And the nature of this gameplay is whimsical, but somewhat serious at the same time. As the name implies, it's dodgeball, and it's 3-on-3, so it's actually 6-on-6. You have three players in the court, and then you have three players outside the court on the opposite side. And the control is pretty simple. B will catch your ball and shoot it, and there are 9 different teams represented by different countries, and there's one team, one of those is an all-star team, but the controls and the gameplay are pretty neat that every character has at least 2 special throws. Some of them have 3. And when you have 2 equally skilled players who have been playing this for quite a while, it really becomes a battle of wits. And it's fantastic. One of the co-hosts on our show is Greg, and he and I have played this, oh man, so many, many times. And it's great because the gameplay is very fast, very frantic. You know, you can catch the ball. Even the special throws can be caught, but the timing's very, very specific. And in order to actually catch those special throws, particularly some of them, you've got to be very good at the game. So it's a game that is easy to pick up and play, but at the same time, it rewards people that, you know, have taken the time to understand the nuances of this game.
And I think that was partly my problem with it. Was this was one that I really wanted to go back to because I knew I was missing those nuances. I think, first of all, you're right. It's like most sports games. It's you ideally need 2 people, don't you, really?
Yeah, it's definitely much more enjoyable as a 2-player game. That's where its strength is. Although, you know, the single player campaign is, you know, being a term for its time, is fun, but it's definitely becomes a battle of wits when you've got 2 people playing. It's so much fun.
Yeah, I mean, I did have sort of fun. It's beautiful graphics, isn't it? As you say, the first time I saw the sort of characters, I was thinking, ooh. Bob, the one that I particularly thought was River City Ransom.
Exactly. You know, another game in the Kunio-kun series.
Exactly,
and it's,
yeah.
The characters have like the super deformed look to them a little bit. Their heads are a little oversized and it's all cartoony looking. But despite that, man, the fighting's serious.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like when you actually you're not just sort of playing for points here, is it? As you throw the ball, like the person goes flying and they turn into an angel, don't they? So you're going for death, really.
It's for good. And, you know, each team is themed differently, and they're actually, although you can't see them, there are stats in the game. Certain teams, you know, they don't have a lot of hit points, but, you know, even the strongest attack will only do 2 or 3 damage. Or certain teams have very particular set of special moves that kind of give the team a certain flavor. So in each individual character within each team has a particular set of special moves. So it's the teams aren't just for appearance. They actually play quite a bit differently.
Yeah, and as I say, it's great. It's got the stereotypes, isn't it, throughout. So, I mean, it's very sort of like you've got your American
Not nearly
team.
As exaggerated as Punch-Out, but the names are a little, a little bit there.
But it reminded me a lot, for those listening in the UK, it reminded me a lot, graphically, of there's an Amiga game called Beach Volleyball that was done by Ocean. It's got that same really impressive graphics for the Nintendo, isn't it? It's really quite amazing what they achieved. I mean, there is some flicker, which I understand is
there's a fair amount of flicker.
Yeah, but,
and, you know,
but you have to accept it's fair to mention. You have to accept it with the older games. But it didn't detract from the sort of the game itself. I mean,
not at all.
As I say, it was one of those when I was playing, I enjoyed it. It was just, I always seemed to be able to hit because I was playing the computer, I always seemed to be able to hit the other computer, and it was quite difficult to dodge when they threw a counter. So for me, it just got a bit of, well, of taking out the others before they take you out, where it felt just less about skill. But I know that's probably, that it's one of those games you just really need to sit down with and spend some serious time with and learn with. Cause there's a lot of nuances, isn't it? You can do sort of jump shot, sort of run up and sort of spike down, super shot, right. and there's quite a lot of combinations, which is amazing, really, with considering you only got a D-pad and two buttons, what they managed to achieve, really.
Yeah, you can initiate a special move by double tapping to run, and you have to shoot the ball or jump and then shoot at the apex on your fifth step, believe it or not. That's the timing. So you initiate a run and you can hear the footsteps. And once you hear that fifth one, that's when you need to throw the ball, because if you go over that fifth one, it reverts back to a normal shot. So there's all these little nuances. And, you know, for example, you're saying you're having trouble, like, avoiding hits. Well, there are three people on your team, but you're only controlling one at a time. What you need to do is the person you're controlling, you need to put that person between whoever has the ball and the rest of your team. Mm. That will allow you to either catch the ball. Now, you can duck under the ball, but if that ball hits one of your teammates behind the one you're controlling, well, that's just not going to help you a whole lot. But it's all about timing and placement, really, positioning.
Definitely. That's definitely one I'm going to sort of come back to with this. It certainly was a good showcase. I can see why you chose it. It's probably, I don't always go for sports games, so perhaps I didn't spend as
neither
much
do I
time.
To be truthful with you,
although it's as sports games go, it's quite it's quite good, isn't it? Really, it's not your normal
makes a good drinking
game.
Game too, by the way.
Ah, I can imagine. But you do you take a shot each time you knock a player.
Yeah, you take a shot every time.
God, you'll be blotted.
You lose one of your players. That gets fun real
fast. I bet. Okay, then what's your next game that you've chosen, Alex?
So the next one is called Pinbot. It was released in 1990. It was developed by Rare, which is a developer I'm sure you're quite familiar with.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And published by Nintendo. And this is a pinball game that is based on a Williams pinball table of the same name. In fact, Pinbot's my favorite pinball table. And what's remarkable about this game is how accurate it is to the actual table, considering you're playing it on an 8-bit platform. The layout of the table is, you couldn't get it any closer if you tried on that hardware. And what's even more impressive is the physics, the ball physics. You can aim your shot exactly where you want, and the ball, for the most part, will behave as you expect it to on a real pinball table. And what was a very intelligent design choice is, obviously, the being a horizontal table, the entire pinball table does not fit on the screen. So the screen will scroll up as the ball goes up the playfield. But what it will do is it will cut off where the flippers are and will leave the flippers at the bottom of the screen no matter where the ball is. That way, when the ball comes back, you know exactly where it is in relation to the flippers. It will never be a surprise to you.
Yeah, it does work exceedingly well, doesn't it? I mean, I'm not too big a fan of pinball games in general, and of course you only get the one table on this.
But sure.
As you say, for an 8-bit, it was amazing physics, really, and I can see why, particularly if you love pinball games, you know, why it would be so popular. I mean, did you have this? So this was one you had?
Yes, I did have this one, growing up. And
yeah.
You know, it's got some pretty impressive speech. And
very good.
Yes. And, you know, it's true that you're playing the same table the entire game. But in an attempt to mix it up, they've kind of broken it down into levels. The first level is just a straight port of the arcade game. The second level, they change the color palette of the whole table, and they start adding little monsters. And at first, I didn't like it, because I'm like, this isn't real pinball. But it occurred to me that if it was nothing but the original table the entire time, I could see how it could get pretty boring. By creating these levels with, and it's not like the screen's littered with monsters, it's just a few here or there. But in doing that, it injects a little bit of freshness into the game, so to keep it from getting too stale. So all the way around, this is a very well crafted pinball game. There's a pseudo sequel to it called High Speed, which is another Williams pinball table, and it's using the same graphics engine as Pinbot. But for my money, there are no better pinball games on the NES than Pinbot or High Speed. You can't go wrong with either one, although I prefer Pinbot.
I particularly like the sexy robot on the title.
Yeah. She's wearing garter belts, for crying out loud. Like,
I know. It's like,
yeah,
really kinky.
And, you know, she's got little pasties on. It's a little risque for Nintendo.
Well, that's it. I wonder who was sleeping on the job at Nintendo.
Exactly.
When they let that one get through.
Yep.
But yeah, no, I mean, I can see. See, for me, the only time I've ever really played pinball games is, and particularly, I'm not that keen on the actual pinball. I just never got into pinball itself. But there was a game series with on the Amiga called Pinball Dreams and Fantasy, and this had a sequel, Pinball Fantasy.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, and I seem to remember actually on one of your podcasts that you hated the series.
Well, I hated the, I want to say it was in a Super Nintendo port.
Yeah.
That was abysmal. It was terrible. And I don't know if that was because it was a bad port or if it, I just didn't like the way the game was designed. That particular game on the NES, the chief complaint the three of us had was that the camera, so to speak, was zoomed in too much on the playfield.
Mm. No, I can see where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. But, I mean, that's the only pinball game that I've ever personally sort of gelled with. But, you know, I can see why you love with this Pinbot. It's, as you say, it faithfully recreates the actual pinball machine. I actually looked at a video of the actual pinball machine it was based on.
So it's remarkably close.
Remarkably. I mean, it's... So I can see people really going for sort of this game. But I'll be honest, it wasn't really... for myself.
That's okay. That's, you know, that's fair. We like what we like, and that's what makes people unique.
Yes,
we don't like
absolutely.
The same things, and that's okay. You know, this game does support like a four-player alternating mode, although that's the one thing about pinball I'm not a big fan of, is if you're playing multiplayer games and you're taking turns and there's four of you, you might be waiting a while for your turn. So...
Not if you're playing with me.
A lot of gutter balls, huh?
Yeah.
But, you know, that being said, like I said, if you enjoy pinball, there is no better pinball game on the NES than Pinbot and High Speed.
Yes. Okay. And it's both done by Rare, is it?
Yes. The yeah, they both are.
Well. I'll have to have a look at that one as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what's your next game then on your list?
So the next game... is one I rented, so many times. And it is called Super C. It was released in 1990. It was developed and published by Konami. It's a two-player simultaneous game. Of course, this game is the sequel to Contra. In Japan, this game was known as Super Contra, but over in Europe, you would know it as Probotector 2, Return of the Evil Forces. A more generic name I don't think you could have found.
I know. I don't know if you've ever seen the Probotector version. They changed all the graphics.
Yeah, so there are no humanoid characters in the Contra series, or in Probotector, rather, at all. They're all robots.
Yeah, and they look quite lame, really.
Yeah,
when you go to play the original. I think it was because Germany get very sensitive with shooting.
You know,
that's why it got changed in the Europe version.
You know, in doing a little bit of research, it seems it's mostly because of Germany that all these European games were heavily censored.
Mm.
And most publishers weren't willing to release a version just for Germany and then the rest for the Europe. So whatever the lowest standard was for... you know, content, with, you know, violent content or sexual content, that's the bar that all of Europe kind of got stuck with. So
yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, you can thank your German neighbors for that.
Although I have to say with the game, I mean, basically it's just like the original Contra, isn't it? It's like a run and gun.
It's a run and gun platformer, right?
Yeah. But one of the things that because when I first started playing it, I absolutely sort of loved it. I've never played Super C on the NES. I mean, obviously played it Super Contra on the SNES, Super Nintendo.
You're missing out.
Yeah, would as I say, it was really, really sort of good fun. I played the US version in the spirit of things, but I was thinking I'm really getting my my ass whipped here, you know, because you've got the constant stream of enemies and often you get in almost like a cycle of death, isn't it, where you get respawned and you go into another.
I call it the cycle of fail, but yeah, it's the same thing.
Yes, exactly. But because I was thinking, well, surely I've not got as, you know, I don't remember it being quite as bad as that when I used to play Probotector 2, and you know, but back in the day, you know, there was the odd friend that had the NES, and it is a bit easier on. They haven't got the frequency, so the robots aren't that constant stream as the guys running. So okay, you don't really encounter that as much. So it is a bit easier with Probotector, but it's definitely, once you gel with the game, though, isn't it? It's like, what seems is impossible, you know, before you know it, you're sort of jumping round backwards and forwards and shooting, you know, it looks so cool once you spend time and learn the patterns. And,
oh, you feel
and
like a badass.
Yeah, you really
you
do.
You feel like Rambo. It's amazing.
Yeah, so, I mean, I had so much sort of fun. I was sort of like a Jedi ninja with a machine gun taking out the streams of enemies. And, you know, you can sort of really sort of master your way through, and then of course you got the level two, isn't it? Well, first of all, you got the end level boss, which really impressed. You got like a super helicopter, isn't it, that you're tackling.
Yeah.
And managed to get through that, and then area two's like an alien breed overhead shooter, isn't it? It's completely different. It's sort of,
yeah, so they replaced the sort of the behind the character sort of pseudo 3D stages in the original Contra. Mm-hmm. They took those away in favor of these overhead stages, which appeared again in Contra 3. And I like them just fine. A lot of people don't like them, but I like them just fine. And one thing that's I always found to be sort of a shame is that Super C has always lived in the shadow of Contra. A lot of people kind of skip over it and just stick with Contra. Mm. And I think that's a bit of a shame, because Super C has some fantastic pacing. The visuals improved. The music is absolutely great. In my opinion, this is some of Konami's best work on the NES. And at least in the North American version, Super C is a little bit easier than Contra. So if you're new to the series, I would actually recommend you start with this one and then switch to Contra. But it's more of the same of Contra, and that's a good thing. It's a little bit short, in my opinion, but it's just fun. And it's, like I said, the pacing's very well done. It introduces some slope services. We talked about the overhead levels, and it's got a few different weapons. There's one fireball weapon, which, if you know how to use it right, you can just crush bosses with that weapon.
I obviously didn't know how to use it right. So, I mean, I find it funny you're saying about its only thing is it's a bit short. I don't think I'd ever finish this game. I got to the jungle level and then just promptly, quickly got killed by those turret things.
Yeah, yeah, I know what you're talking about. But again, this is a game I rented so many times.
Yeah.
And just, I think all the games on this list I have beat it at some point, at least once. But this is one I beat multiple times. It's just, again, when this is the only fresh game I had for an entire weekend, I'm going to put some time into it as a kid. So
yeah,
this one's really a lot of fun. And like I said, it gets overlooked for Contra quite a bit. And I think that's a shame. This is an excellent successor to Contra.
No, but absolutely. I mean, once you learn the patterns, isn't it? Sort of memorizing, you can see how you can get really good at this game. It's just, it's certainly a real test, one of the ultimate tests out there for true gaming prowess, isn't it? With these sort of games where you literally have to have sort of like the reflexes of a cat as you and as you battle your way through.
this game is up there in that regards, yes.
Yeah, but no, I can see, particularly as a kid when you've got lots and lots of time, how this could, you could learn to master this game throughout. So you've actually completed this game then, I take it?
Given quite a number of times.
Quite a number of times. Yeah. God, you're on a different gaming playing level to me, Alex. <It's> I'm not worthy.
These NES side-scrolling action platformers—they were—they were—they're my bread and butter. They're games I love to play the most on the NES. And so, after you played several dozens of them, you kind of get the idea of what you know, what to do and how to do it, and sort of you almost even start to understand how some of the enemy AI is programmed and stuff like that. So. Mm.
So you sort of break it down and learn from scratch. No, I mean, it's for those who've not played it, you know, this is definitely a classic game. It's amazing what they did on the NES, isn't it? I'd definitely recommend this one.
Yep.
Okay, what's your next game then, Alex?
So the next game is probably one of the most quote-unquote mainstream titles on this list, and it's another Konami title. And I'm kind of gazing at the list right now. I actually have about 4 Konami titles out of 10, were, you know, so that just tells you how prolific and successful Konami was on the NES in the 8-bit days. They were just knocking them out of the park.
Yeah.
But that being said, the next title is Castlevania 3 Dracula's Curse. Yeah. It was released in 1990, and in Japan this game is known as Akumajou Densetsu. And the North American European version, I believe the European version also, it's available in all 3 of Nintendo's virtual consoles. But Castlevania 3, another side-scrolling action platformer, and this sort of eschews some of the exploration and sort of Metroid-like elements of Castlevania 2 in favor of the more linear approach that the original Castlevania had. What is different and new about this game is that it introduces branching paths, and that adds a little bit of longevity to the game. But even more importantly, it gives you 3 new playable characters. So at any given point, you're always going to have Trevor Belmont, but you can also have either Grant, Sifa, or Alucard. And they're really a welcome addition to the cast, particularly Sifa, actually. Her special attacks are very powerful, and she's just a fun character to use because she's so different from the rest of them. But is as standard as it was for Castlevania on the NES, this game is very challenging. It's also very long. This one's got a password system, and deservedly so.
I was glad with the password system.
Even back in the day when I had all the time in the world to play games, there was no way I could do this in one sitting. It's just a little too much. But, you know, it's more of Castlevania, but even better. The music is fantastic. Especially
stunning, isn't it?
Yes, especially the Japanese version. Because the Famicom version of this game had another sound chip inside the cartridge, which added another, I want to say, 2 sound channels to the NES. And the musical score on the Famicom version is among the best music I've ever heard for the platform. It's absolutely spectacular. But this game does a really good job with atmosphere. It's very spooky, very foreboding, cool boss fights.
I was so glad that you chose this game, because I'll be honest, I've never really sort of particularly gelled with Castlevania games. I think the mistake I've always made, I've gone to, you know, start at the first one, Castlevania 1.
The first one's brutally difficult. It's...
Yeah.
I only beat the first game once, and I will never... I have no desire to do it again. And there's a few games that I've played on the NES where I beat them once and told myself never again. I'll play them for the enjoyment of playing them, but I'm not going to try to beat that one again.
But I'm so glad with this one. This is one of the few that I've of the Castlevania series that I've really sort of gelled with, and I'm like, okay, I get why this is so highly revered. I mean, it's amazing graphics and music. A lot of the music that plays in this one, it was like, that's, because often it's the ones that, you know, when you hear people do
you'll hear it remastered in later Castlevania games.
And it's just stunning music throughout. The only thing I found that was slightly annoying is that often I was dying on the stairs because I wasn't quite aligned.
Yeah, that's something you unfortunately just have to get used to.
Yeah.
particularly when you're using Trevor, the controls are very rigid. So, for example, if you jump using Trevor, or just about all the characters except for Grant, if you jump, you're committing to that jump. You can't change your mind and go back in midair. So that's always been a staple of all three Castlevania games. Again, Grant notwithstanding, he can actually change direction in mid-jump. But yeah, the stairs thing takes a little getting used to. I always make it a habit to hold like diagonally down as I'm approaching the end of a platform, so I make sure I hit the stairs.
So diagonally down to make sure you hit.
That's
it.
What I've always That's done, it. Yeah.
Okay, I'll perhaps have to learn with that. Because, as I say, my jaw was on the floor with so much with this. I mean, I did get quite, you know, I went through quite far with it. And it's just amazing the, you know, like first of all, when you get your choice path, that was like, wow, that's fantastic. You can choose.
Yeah.
And then, you know, with the clock tower level with the pendulum swinging, and you're like, surely that's not a platform you can jump on. Surely, you know. And it's, it's just amazing what they managed to do with the Nintendo. It was just, I'll be honest, I got to the point where I was really enjoying it, but I kept on going back, you know, because you got the password to start from that point.
Right.
And I got a bit stroppy with it and rage quit. Because I kept on dying. And it was, the thing is, I don't mind when you're dying because you've been hit by monsters, but is when you, like, yet again, particularly on the, you know, clock towers and a little bit further on, you know, it's just because you're not going up the ladder properly and you just fall. And even when you know there's like some what would have been steps right underneath it, you still die, don't you? Still.
Yeah.
It got me a little frustrated with it, but this is certainly, probably outside of Symphony of the Night, probably the one that I've really gelled with the Castlevania. Still not entirely sure with those hearts. I think it's something to do with magic, isn't it?
But the hearts are what you use to use your special weapons, regardless of which character you're using. So that's what the hearts do for you. So the dagger, for example, I want to say it only takes one or two hearts to throw. But for example, the clock, I want to say the stopwatch uses 10 or something like that. So different weapons require a different number of hearts in order to use them. And again, the female character, Sifa, her spells or her special attacks are incredibly powerful. And you can use that to beat quite a few of the bosses, but they take quite a few hearts as well. So
it's good to save them up. Because it took me ages. I knew it was. Eventually, sort of dawned on me that it was to do with the that the hearts were to do with the sort of power ups. But it was like,
Most games, like, hearts give you restore your life, but not
exactly.
Not
I was like, why
game.
Is the health not going up? I'm collecting loads here.
So in this game, we have a joke on Retro Game Squad. We call it Wall Chicken, and it's a Castlevania thing. So there'll be a brick wall, and you whip it, and there's a plate of chicken in there. So we call it Wall Chicken. So that's how you regain health in Castlevania, is by eating Wall Chicken.
Wall Chicken. Only the finest.
Exactly.
No, it's a great game, and I think we'll play some of the music from the game.
Oh, fantastic.
Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that music, as we certainly did. So, Alex, what's your next game on your list?
Yet another Konami title.
You love your Konami.
I just had an affinity for their games on the NES. They were really, really good.
Yeah.
This one looks like it was a North American-only release, and it's called Cyber Stadium Series Base Wars. And as the name somewhat implies, this is a baseball game. but instead of having humanoid players, you have robots. So, I don't normally like sports games, but this game is so much fun. Because instead of just, it's not just that you're playing with robots, is that there's combat involved. And the way it works is if you try to steal a base, and either the fielder or a baseman touches you with a ball and catches you, well, instead of just being out, you fight whether you get to steal that base or not. And it's so much fun because there's four different types of robots, and they have different characteristics. So, for example, you have like a tank robot who's good at combat and has high defense, or you have the motorcycle robot, which is very fast, or the flying robots, or the standard humanoid robot. And aside from that, in order to help you in combat, there are different weapons you can buy. And there, you can also upgrade each individual robot on your team as you're going through the season mode. So you earn money as you play games, and then you need to repair your robots and then buy upgrades and new weapons and armor and engines and catching abilities and shooting for your pitcher. It's a lot of fun, and it has a surprising amount of depth.
Yeah, I mean, I was quite surprised with this. I mean, the reason it probably didn't get released over here, we don't really follow baseball in
yeah,
the UK.
I didn't think it would be very popular in Europe.
No. Well, I mean, we'd like some of the arcade. I mean, RBI Baseball, I remember playing. And this one reminded me a lot of, which I've played later on, as 2020 Baseball.
Yeah, Super Baseball 2020. Yeah, it's a great game. You know, either the Neo Geo or the Mega Drive version are really good.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But yeah, no, I mean, for baseball, we call it rounders here, kind of.
Okay.
and it was what the girls used to play at school.
Oh, I see how it is. I see how it is. That's okay.
Coming in and swinging. You see that?
That's okay. I'm born Canadian, so I'm a hockey guy. That's all right.
All right. Well, yeah. No, we find it particularly funny in the UK that Americans call it the World Series.
It's not. It's like it's really the North American World Series. There's only one U.S. team left in baseball, if I'm not mistaken. So,
but no, I mean that aside, it's a great fun. I had a lot of fun with this game because it's very arcadey. And the first time you go into that fighting, isn't it? I was like, what the hell is going on? What?
It's great. And so during each game, your robot has a life bar.
Yeah.
When you get into a fight, so if you're stealing a base, your life bar is dependent on how close you are to the base you're trying to steal. So, for example, if you're on first base and you're trying to steal second, and you make a run for it, but you only get about 5 steps away from first base, you'll have virtually no health. But if you're only about a step or two away from where second base is, you'll have nearly a full life bar. So it creates sort of a risk-reward ratio. You don't want to steal a base unless you're pretty sure you can get to it.
Yeah.
Because not only will you lose that fight, your robot has an overall health stat. And if that gets if you lose too many fights and that health stat drops to 0, that robot explodes. And it's awesome.
Yes, it's so... The animation and everything about is so good, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's got, like, really impressive speech, as a matter of fact.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Actually, I was quite impressed with quite a few of the games that we're going to cover, is the speech you mentioned with, like, Pinbot and that.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. I didn't realize that NES was that capable of doing such good speech.
I didn't either, and I'll tell you, the very first time I ever heard speech on the NES was Blades of Steel, which is a hockey game.
Mm.
And I remember vividly sitting in my friend's room, and he turned on the power button, and the NES said, Blades of Steel, and my jaw hit the floor. But yes, Base Wars is another game that I rented a number of times, and it just occurred to me one day, man, I used to play the hell out of that game. I need to pick this up.
Yeah.
And you can customize your team name, your robot's name. So you can customize the heck out of your team. You know, not just in name, but like we'd mentioned earlier, both in the upgrades and so on and so forth. It's a simple arcade-style baseball game that doesn't take itself too seriously, but you could play seriously. It does support two players, so...
that's what I was saying. That was the thing in the back of my mind. This would be so much fun with another human player, particularly with the fighting, isn't it?
Yes. You would. You know? It's almost like you want to steal bases on purpose just to get into a fight.
And it's little touches as well. It's like when you're pitching, if you actually hit the robot enough times, they explode as well.
Yeah.
Don't they?
That's hilarious.
It's just lovely little touches. I can see why you chose this. It's a lot of fun. And in some ways, as much as I love 2020 baseball, this stands on its own because it's got the fighting element in, isn't it? It's well worth for those who've played things like 2020 baseball.
Yeah, if you did like that game, I think this game will definitely appeal to you. And it's a game, again, that kind of flew under the radar. And not too many people, I think, really are aware of it. So if since we don't think it saw a European release, I don't think you'll come across it very often. But if you ever do, I would recommend picking it up. It's a fairly cheap game. So if you ever are on a trip to North America and you come across it, I would recommend picking it up.
Yeah, definitely. I would recommend this one as well. This is was so much fun. I really want to try next time I have like a gaming night with some of my friends here. I'm gonna try and play over a few beers with a two player. I think it's gonna be so much fun.
I agree. That's the best way to do it.
but graphically, it's very impressive as well. I couldn't believe how big the sprites are again.
Especially during the fight sequences, yeah, I was pretty impressed.
Yeah, because I was, and but even when you go up to bat, you know, I mean, it's quite a big, you know, sprite characters and everything. Yeah, very impressive. I was chuffed that you sort of introduced me to this because it reminded me a lot of the kind of baseball that I like, which is robots and explosions.
Everything's better with robots and explosions. What are you talking about?
Absolutely.
It's the best part.
Exactly. Okay, so what's your next choice?
So the next one is a title by Sunsoft, as a matter of fact. This one is Batman Return of the Joker. It was released in 1991. It also saw a release on the Game Boy and the Genesis, although they don't hold a candle to the NES version.
No, you're absolutely right. Sorry, carry on.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying I'd played the Mega Drive one before.
And, it's terrible.
It's terrible.
It's absolutely horrible.
Compared to the NES one, I was just blown away how much better this one was.
Yes, and I can say with a fair amount of confidence, this game has probably the best graphics I've ever seen out of any NES game.
Yeah, how did they do it? Every time I was looking, I was thinking, did I accidentally choose Super Nintendo or something?
if you were to just glance at it briefly, you might mistake it for a 16-bit title. The graphics are just breathtaking. The sprites are not only large, they animate very beautifully. There's a tremendous amount of detail. For example, when Batman jumps and he lands, his cape flows in the wind. It's just so much detail. It's got parallax in all the stages in the background, and all the enemies animate really well. And as was typical for Sunsoft at this time, the music is just outstanding. I can't praise the visuals and the music enough. They're just among, if not the best you'll ever find on the platform.
Oh, definitely. It's so good sort of playing through, isn't it? You start with the first level and you're sort of just battling your way through standard sort of left to right sort of scrolling. And then you come to level two where you're sort of fighting this, I don't know what it's, massive flying.
It's like a dirigible
blimp,
or a zeppelin,
isn't it, or something. Yeah, it's like a zeppelin. Yeah, and it's just there's so much variety. You know, as I managed to make my way through, you even get the R-type sort of shooting levels where Batman wears a jetpack and he's like flying through and shooting out the enemies.
And I think it was wise of them to put those shoot 'em up style stages in the game, because one criticism I think that's fair to say about this game is that it gets, even though there's a lot of variety in the backgrounds and they're all gorgeous and they all look unique, the gameplay itself does get sort of repetitive. And I think those shoot 'em up stages were a wise choice to kind of help break up monotony a little bit. Mm. Because I'm going to be completely honest, this is one of my favorite games, but it's not a particularly fantastic game, because it feels like a generic action platformer with the Batman license slapped on.
Yeah.
That being said, it's still a very competent game. It controls well, it plays well. It's a bit on the easy side as far as the rest of the games on this list are concerned.
Yeah. Us mere mortals can play it.
And it's got some of the most gorgeous box art I've ever seen in any video game.
It is good, isn't it?
It's incredible. And the art design in the game throughout is actually quite good.
Yeah, I was blown. I mean, for me, this is definitely up there with my favorite. I love Batman, and there isn't that many. Well, there is. I suppose there are some good Batman games.
The game that came out prior to this was just titled Batman. It was another Sunsoft game. That was another action platformer, and the sprites were much smaller, but it had nice visuals, just the same. But that game was brutally difficult. I never really got into that one, although I do want to play it because it looks like something I could really sink my teeth into.
I used to love the one on the Game Boy. I used to have Batman on the Game Boy, which was also Sunsoft.
Right.
And that's really cute and sort of fun version. But no, with this one, I really, really sort of gelled with it. It's you got a password system, so you never felt, you have to go through it all again. So some bits I didn't like. There were some bits, deaths which I considered a bit cheap. There were some bad enemies.
Yeah, on the snow level, you'll be walking along and a grenade gets thrown in your face out of nowhere.
Yes. Yeah.
It's
like,
so,
no.
yeah, there are some cheap deaths, but like the majority of these platforms on the NES, it's memorization is a big part of it. This is another one, I played quite a bit, and it just, again, it's just a matter of memorization, but it's not as punishingly difficult as some of the other games on this list, that's for sure.
No, you're absolutely right. I managed to get sort of further. The bit that really got my anger up, though, was those bloody tornado throwing enemies. They just sort of like
the amount of deaths suck. I lost. Yeah, they're obnoxious.
But no, I was blown away. This is by far, for me, one of the prettiest titles I'd seen on ever on the NES. I really think it's sort of up there. And I suppose by 1991, people were already looking towards the next console, wasn't it? Because you would have had the Mega Drive out at this point and the Super Nintendo probably out at this point, because it was right at the end of 1991. Mm-hmm. So you're probably playing it in 1992.
Yeah.
So Were you quite an early adopter, or did you know these games because you sort of stuck with the NES to the, well, I don't want to say bitter end, but stuck with the NES? Were you quite a late adopter to the Super Nintendo, or did you next?
I bought my Super Nintendo, it was 1994, or 90, no, it was 1992 or 1993 I bought my Super Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
So to that end, yeah, I still stuck with my NES. It's never not been connected to a TV in my home. My NES has always been hooked up.
Yeah.
I never stopped, kind of investigating NES games, even though I had a Super Nintendo. I still had an appreciation for the older systems.
No, I can see why. With games coming out like this, I can see why you would stick with it. It's did you go switch to the Mega Drive then? Is that what you did?
No, I went. I was a Nintendo boy at first, so I went from NES to Super NES, And then one day, a friend of mine in high school, we would banter back and forth between which was better, the Super NES or the Genesis.
Yeah.
And then we would get together once in a while, and he'd bring his Genesis over. And then one day he brought over Streets of Rage 2. And that's when, that was pretty much the pivotal point where I became platform agnostic. That game single-handedly made me run out and buy a Genesis. And then from there, I began to appreciate the Genesis. It's pretty rich library. So, and from then on, I was actually a little bit of a Sega boy.
Yes.
Then I went on to the Saturn. I'm a diehard Saturn enthusiast. The only platform I think I love more than NES is actually the Sega Saturn. So, yeah, it's good to have an open mind.
And
it's hard to do when you're a kid and, you know, your parents would only get you one system or you can only afford one system. Then, you know, that's kind of difficult to do. But especially as these systems got older and the hardware and the software, got cheaper and cheaper, I got my own job. It became realistic for me to be able to afford to expand my library a little bit without it costing me a fortune.
Mm. No, absolutely. And that's exactly how I've sort of gone as well, as I've a lot of these systems I've gone back and bought, and I love my Saturn, but I've learned to appreciate the Sony PlayStation equally, and you know, I love my N64. You know, they're all great in their own way, and they all have their own unique games on them.
That's exactly right. They all have something great to offer that's different.
Yes,
that the others can't offer us. So it's good to sample a little bit of everything. You know, it's like cuisine. You know, eat Thai one day, eat Indian food the next. Try different things. You never know what you're going to like.
Absolutely. Okay, well, what's the next game on the list?
Next game is another Konami game. And this is, again, one of those games that came out really, really late in the NES's life cycle. And similar to Super C, this game often gets overlooked for its predecessor. And the game in question is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3, The Manhattan Project. Of course, over there you know them as the Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles, because we all know ninjas are evil.
Absolutely. They're saving our souls by dropping the word ninja.
it's crazy.
It is.
But this game was released in 1992, again developed and published by Konami. It's a two-player beat-em-up. And over in Japan, this game is actually known as Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2. But this game never saw a European release, which I found to be pretty surprising when I looked into that.
Yeah, it's because the Nintendo really wasn't, particularly at this point.
Yeah, and seeing how it came out so late in the system's life cycle, it's easy to see how it was kind of...
Yeah, because it was America. It was 1992, wasn't it? So
yeah.
By that time, you know, people
that ship had set
towards...
sail for Nintendo already. I think
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Anybody who was going to play consoles was on the Mega Drive at that point, really.
Right. So this is another beat 'em up, very similar to the predecessor, which was Ninja Turtles 2, the arcade game. And a lot of people have such warm, fuzzy memories of the arcade game, and they sort of transpose that onto the NES version. But this game is in every way better. And it's a shame that it gets overlooked so often for the arcade game, because this game is... got a lot more variety in the stages and the scenarios. The music and the visuals are slightly improved. You have a little bit of an expanded moveset from the previous game. And it's, like majority of the Ninja Turtles games, it's got an upbeat and enjoyable tone to it. And despite its featuring of, you know, evil ninjas, I think it's actually appropriate for kids.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you showed me this game and it was on your list, because I would never have played it. And you're right, it's even better, I think, in many ways than the arcade game. It just plays so well, doesn't it? I mean, it starts off with the turtles on holiday in Florida.
Right.
Sort of like, all with their sunshades. You'd think turtles probably wouldn't like sunshine, but these turtles do.
I guess so.
They just catch on the TV, isn't it? Interrupted by sort of Shredder, the evil dude. And he takes away the whole of Manhattan Island and the newscaster April O'Neil.
Of course.
And, of course, and you have to go and take out all the henchmen, and it's basically plays like the arcade game, but there's a lot more complexity, I noticed, with the controls a bit from the arcade game. You can sort of different moves. There's certainly a nice range of enemies that you encounter.
Yeah, there are.
But I just love the locales with it. I mean, you start off, you're on Florida Beach. That's the first level, isn't it?
Yep.
And you're sort of battling your way through, and it's all so bright and colourful, beautiful graphics. Again, amazing what they produce for the NES. Sometimes you have that flicker problem that we mentioned, where I think for technical reasons, sometimes your turtle disappears slightly, occasionally, isn't it? But nothing that ruins the gameplay at all.
No, not at all.
No, and I had so much fun. The enemies as well are really impressive. I mean, you've really got the A-list of roster of characters. You've you Bebop and
Rocksteady
are there. Really good. There was some of the others, because I perhaps didn't see all the cartoons back in the day. There was a bull character. I don't know who he was.
Some of the boss enemies are from the cartoon show. Some of them were from the movie, the Ninja Turtles 2 movie. And then it looked like maybe some of them were original creations. And they all have, you know, their own unique attack styles and such. But there's one boss in particular, I always get a smile on my face when I play him. His name is Dirtbag. And he's like a miner rat. He's a rat who mines. He's got like a hard hat and a pickaxe.
Yeah, I assumed he was a mole. Is he a rat?
I don't know if he's a rat or a mole. I think he's a rat. And when you first encounter him, you're in a subway system, and he's on a mine cart. And the boss music starts playing, but he overshoots and drives right by you. And the boss music kind of dies off. And then he turns around and comes back and then stops the minecart where it's supposed to be, and he jumps and fights you. But it's a fun boss fight. And this game is basically the NES's answer or equivalent of Turtles in Time.
Mm. Yeah, I noticed, because there's one bit on a bridge, isn't it? And I thought that's Turtles in Time. That's like, you know.
Yeah, I don't.
One of the levels.
I don't mean thematically so much as like, this is the NES's equivalent of that game. It's a very long game. It's very fun. It's a blast to play with somebody alongside you.
Yeah.
And, you know, much like Hyperstone Heist and Turtles in Time, this is the NES's answer to those two games. And it's better, as good as the predecessor was, this is better in every way. And you know, you got enemies popping out all sorts of crazy places. When you're on the beach, they jump out from behind billboards, or the second stage, you're surfing from Florida to Manhattan, which I don't know.
Yeah, that's
a
great level, isn't it? Yeah.
But their enemies just pop busting out of like storefront windows and manholes and all over the place, and it's just fun, and it does invoke the spirit of the cartoon pretty well, even though it doesn't particularly follow the plot. It just has the spirit of the essence of the Ninja Turtles.
The only thing I found a bit disturbing were those sort of muscular speedo wearing swimmers that you encounter with machine guns.
Oh, yeah.
It was a bit like, that's too much skin you're showing there. Yeah. I don't like that.
Speedos are a scary thing. They can be frightening. Nobody wants to see the banana hammock any time of day.
Exactly. Well, at least it wasn't a mankini, I suppose it could be. But it's an amazing game. I was just like, how is this working on the NES? But of course, as we're going later on in time, isn't it?
Yeah.
With the NES, they'd really learned how to use the system. No, I loved it. I loved the music, just everything about this game. Because as I say, it was just like discovering the equivalent of discovering, oh, there's another arcade game of the Turtles. It was literally like
great,
more levels. Yeah, no, brilliant. As I say, definitely one that I want to see right the way through to the end, because it's not too difficult, this one. It's a long game,
but it's not overtly difficult.
Yeah, I definitely want to sort of stick with it right the way through to the end. I just sort of ran out of time, but I got quite far through it and loved every minute of it. But definitely, like all these sort of scrolling beat 'em ups, it's always better with a friend.
Always.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, very impressive. Okay, so what's your next game?
Like a ghost in the moonlight, the ninja warrior stalks his prey. Unseen, unheard, and unnoticed. Mission accomplished. The final battle begins. Ninja Gaiden for Nintendo from Tecmo.
So looks like we're down to our last game, and I wanted to save my absolute favorite NES game for last, and my favorite NES game of all time is Ninja Gaiden, or Ninja Gaiden, depending on how you prefer to pronounce it, but growing up, we always called it Gaiden, so I'm
I did a little bit of research, and according to the holy tome that is the Wizard film...
Oh, it's Ninja Gaiden. Hi!
Gaiden!
Ninja Gaiden! Hi!
Yes, so that must be right.
Who's to say? But I'm going to call it Ninja Gaiden just the same, even though it may be incorrect.
Yeah, who cares at the end of the day?
Yeah. But this one was released in 1989. It's developed and polished by Tecmo. In Japan, this game is known as Ninja Ryukenden. And of course, in Europe, because once again, ninjas can't be around because they're evil. So you guys know it as Shadow Warriors, which makes no sense.
Yeah, it's quite weird with that. I mean, because a lot of the ports that we had were totally different to the NES version as well. Have you ever played the arcade Ninja Gaiden?
No, I have not. And that is, the arcade game is an entirely different game. It's the arcade game is a beat-em-up, whereas the NES game is a side-scrolling hack-and-slash platformer of the most beautifully, deliciously difficult variety.
Yeah, again, this was pleasantly surprised because I'd played sort of Ninja Gaiden sort of like on the Spectrum and Amiga and different consoles, but they were all, of course, known as Shadow Warrior. But of course, it was based on the arcade game, which is like a scrolling, as you say, basically like Double Dragon.
Sure.
So I wasn't my cup of tea, to be honest. I wasn't that sort of keen. So I'd sort of never really sat down with Ninja Gaiden on like the consoles until quite recently. And particularly, as I say, I played the... I love the one on the Master System, which is a totally different game to the NES.
I would love to play that version. Deal. As much as I love this, the NES version, I've never touched the Master System version. I'd like to do so shortly, yeah.
Okay, well, if we find out it's your Master System, if we find out it's multi-region, I might be able to help you out on that. So
appreciate it.
Yeah, as I say, I loved it on the Master System, but I've really gained an appreciation for the NES version because I sat down, and this was one of the few games where I got very, very far. I was quite proud of myself without any cheats after playing and replaying, and then I took the wimpy way out and used save states. But I did go right the way through to the end, and I loved every minute of it. I spent a lot of time in this game.
So as a matter of fact, I'm a little sleep deprived because I might have stayed up till 2 in the morning just so I could beat it again.
I bet with your climate, it's just,
well,
you probably don't even lose a life, do you?
You know, this game, I actually have the copy. The copy I have is from my childhood, and I bought it off my friend. In fact, his name is still in Sharpie on the cartridge, and I'll leave it that way. But there was one summer where I just played this game over and over and over and over, and I used to sit down and just play it once or twice a weekend just for fun. And this game is what I love about it so much. Never mind the cutscenes and the plot are well ahead of its time. They
absolutely
may seem rather simplistic
in
nature by today's standards, but at the time, the plot and the cutscenes were not something you really saw much of at all on the NES at the time.
Or anywhere, really. I mean, as you say, it was ahead of its time. And there's some beauty to the simplicity, just like when they show the Ryu sort of running, you know, the ninja running from the side.
Right, it's, yeah.
It's just such a simple effect, just as they're using sort of anime techniques. They sort of just have him, sort of the head moving up and down.
Yeah.
And then, and then lines to denote speed. And it just really sort of tells the story incredibly well. And it's a really good story as well. I was really impressed, and that was one of the reasons I was desperate to see it right the way through to the end, was because of that story.
Yeah, it, you know, you bring up a very good point about the cutscenes being anime inspired. They really are, and it's really clever on Tecmo's part, because it was something in the NES could pull off, and not only did they pull it off, but it's quite elegant for its time, and it's, you know. They carried that in the next two games on the NES, but this one's my favorite. And the reason being, the gameplay is very difficult, but that's not to say there aren't a few cheap deaths here and there. However, it's the kind of difficult that is extremely rewarding. And it's the kind of difficult that if you practice enough, you can and will get past it. It's just a matter of practice and memorization. And you, it also requires pretty darn fast reflexes. If those kinds of things seem like something that might appeal to you, there are a few games on the NES that are have more razor-sharp, precise gameplay and control than Ninja Gaiden. And that's part of the appeal. It's the combination of the difficulty, the razor-sharp control, and the gameplay mechanics that keep drawing me to this game. And it's, as I've said, it's literally my favorite NES game of all time.
And I can see why. I mean, there are some things that sort of frustrate a bit. Like, sometimes you get, when you jump up, you grab onto the wall, and sometimes you're like, can't get down as easy as you would have liked. You know, I mean, what's it with like the bats and birds being able to kill you? You're supposed to be a rock ass ninja.
Everybody talks about this. There's one deadly jump in stage 6-2, and there's this eagle flying in from off screen, and there's a dude throwing daggers on a ledge, and you know, it's all just a matter of practice and figuring out how to, you know, how to approach and tackle the situation. And, you know, again, it really does demand fast reflexes on your part and to memorize the stages through and through. But, you know, it's everything about the game. It's how badass Ryu is and how demonic all the enemies are and the stage layout, how sadistic
the respawning
is.
Enemy as well. I mean,
almost
as soon as you killed, it's just a constant stream, isn't it, if you're not careful?
There are tricks. You can actually use that to your advantage, I found. One of these days I'd like to record myself playing it, because there are tricks you can do where the enemy appears on screen, but they backpedal. And if they backpedal to a certain point and you cut the screen off, they disappear, and then you can go. It's just little tricks like that. That I used to help me get past the game.
Yeah, because I mean that was one that really frustrated me with the. You used to get those sort of like, was it the sword wielding enemies? I think it was, and they're on
the green samurai.
Yeah. And they're sort of down, and it's just next to impossible to take them out with you, because you're like, well, how do I get them? and of course, if you jump on them or what have you, which of course that damages you, you end up always going down a pit.
Oh, you'll usually get knocked back to into an abyss. You're right.
But it seems to sort of take a beeline, doesn't it? It's like, I'm not going to put you in the worst, land you in the worst place possible.
There's that fail pattern again.
I'm basically a bad loser, isn't it? But I mean, I did do quite well. I got to stage 4.
That's pretty good.
I was quite proud. It was a lot of play, wash, repeat.
Sure.
But then, yeah, and I only did use save states, so it wasn't too bad. But I did use a lot of them. But it's a great game, and it's just great with the, you know, you even fight your father, isn't it? And your father, you find out he's alive.
Spoiler warning.
Oh, sorry, spoiler warning.
It's okay. I think we're okay.
I think we're past the...
I think after 25 years, it's okay.
But, yeah, I just loved it. It's a lot of variety. Music is absolutely stunning.
It's good.
It's really good.
The theme to the boss music is just awesome. I've always loved it. And, you know, they kept that same basic beat in Ninja Gaiden 2 and 3, just kind of synthesized a little bit differently. But, yeah, the bosses are fun. There are all sorts of little tricks you can do to just decimate the bosses. There's a particular move called the spin slash technique. Mm-hmm. And you can literally kill the majority of the bosses in about a second. Maybe some of them you have to run up to them, so it takes 2 seconds.
Wow.
But, you know, they're like the first boss, you just run up to him and jump over him as you spin splash. He dies in about 1 second. Same thing with the second boss. In fact, you can kill all the bosses in the game in about a second, except for the very last boss with that weapon. So it's just years and years of playing this game and figuring this stuff out. You know, there was no internet. There was no, you know, no game facts or anything. It's just I played this over the course of that one summer so many times. I learned the game. It's literally become muscle memory to me.
And,
you know, my cartridge is all worn from being, you know, like the pins are all worn inside the cartridge. But I love the game so much.
Because are the sequels just as punishing?
So here's the interesting thing. As far as the North American releases go, in order of difficulty, the easiest is Ninja Gaiden 2, then Ninja Gaiden 1, and then Ninja Gaiden 3 is beyond brutal. I have beat all three of them. I beat the first two games multiple times. Now, the third game I've only beaten once, and I recorded it on VHS at the time, and I've since lost the tape, I've misplaced it. It's in my house somewhere. But what's kind of messed up, and we've talked about this on Retro Game Squad in the past, the Japanese version of Ninja Gaiden 3 is considerably easier. When they brought the game to North America, they limited you to 5 continues, doubled the amount of damage you take, and reorganized some of the enemy placement to make the stages harder. So it depends on which version of the game you're playing. But as I said, if you're playing, for example, the North American version, Ninja Gaiden 2 is actually the easiest. Not that it's an easy game, mind you.
But it's because that's one of the things. One of the nice things about Ninja Gaiden, the first one, is it was infinite continues, wasn't it?
It is, and the second game's the same way.
Yeah. But the third one they changed it.
Yeah, you only have 5 continues in the North American version, and again, their enemies in the first two games that only do like take off 1 bar of life. In Ninja Gaiden 3, the least amount of damage you'll take is 2 bars. So, love the whole trilogy, but the first game will always have a special place in my heart.
I can see why. I mean, this would have blown my mind as a kid seeing this.
Yeah, and then we have a joke on Retro Game Squad. The joke is hot knife through butter. One of the first episodes we did, I meant to say that the gameplay in this game is like a hot knife through hot knife through butter, but I ended up saying hot butter through knife. So that's a running gag we have on our show. But this game is like hot butter through knife.
Yeah,
it's when you get proficient at the game, it's like your razor blade just slicing through your enemies. It really is a really good feeling.
You get it when you get in the zone, absolutely.
Yeah.
And one of the things interesting, actually, with this, Hideo Yoshizawa was the designer when I was looking on, like, Moby Games. And he went on to work for Namco, and he did Ridge Racer R4, which I know is you're a fan as much as I am.
That's a fantastic racing game, yes.
Yeah, so it's interesting to see. I always love looking on Moby Games. You get to see... providing if it's accurate, but you always get to see where these developers went on, you know, what they went on to do. He also did the Driller games on Namco.
Okay.
Like those sort of games. But it's amazing, isn't it? I can see why you absolutely adored it. So, thank you so much for covering, you know, all these games, Alex.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on and indulging me as I put you through all these rock-hard, difficult games.
Exactly. You've made me realize even more than I realized before how rubbish I am at games.
You're welcome. It's you know, I'm very honored to be on the show, and I appreciate it very much.
Well, it's been great having you on here as well. You know, as I say, I've really enjoyed as much as I love your Retro Game Squad podcast. As I say, I always look forward to it each month, and I urge everyone listening to give their podcast a try as well. You'll enjoy it as well. It's one of the few American podcasts I really personally gel with. But is there any sort of greets and hellos you want to say beforehand? Before we wrap up?
Not really. Just, if you like some of what you heard today and you want to check out Retro Game Squad, please do so. You can go to RetroGameSquad.com. You'll find links to our RSS feed and iTunes and all that other fun stuff. And, you know, we're a monthly podcast, as Driscoll mentioned, and we're based here in the U.S. But it's myself and my co-hosts, Jeff and John, who I have a lot of fun with.
Yeah.
We have differing tastes in gaming, rather, and that kind of helps the dynamic in the show. It forces each of us to play games we wouldn't otherwise want to, and it makes some pretty good banter and what's the word I'm looking for? I suppose it's some discourse and some...
it works really well, though, doesn't it? Because you've basically got... Alex is the sort of the... sort of sensei, sort of
veteran gamer. I'm the older gentleman on the show. Jeff and John are about 10 or 12 years younger than me. So they've played their fair share of aping games, but it's fun to have the different perspective of somebody who didn't necessarily grow up with this stuff, but still has an appreciation for them. Jeff is awesome. He's the comedic relief. And then John is our resident brainiac. He's a super intelligent dude, and he's often quiet, but when he has something to say, it's usually pretty profound. So, you know, I enjoy doing the show with him. And Drisk, I've always appreciated you being such a vocal part of our community, because it's pretty striking that a good percentage of our listenership is actually in Europe and Australia. Mm. Not sure how the heck that happened, but you know, it's pretty amazing to be able to reach out to people all over the world. Just how you guys are doing with Retro Asylum. You know, I listen to you guys too, so it's really good to get a different perspective from people who are into retro gaming, but a different side of retro gaming that maybe you're not accustomed to or familiar with. So that's a benefit of me for as far as listening to Retro Asylum, is I get to hear about all these computer games, like the ZX Spectrum games and the Amiga games and all this kind of stuff I wasn't exposed to and know very little about. So it's a very informative experience for me to listen to you guys.
And I'm the exact same way with, Retro Game Squad, is that, hearing the US perspective is just wonderful. And as you say, it's a lovely group of within the community. Hello to Mads and Clint and Carl and everyone else there, isn't it?
Yeah. They're really good guys, and
yeah.
You know, Mads has been very helpful. Clint has been helpful. Trantor has been really nice, really supportive. And, it's really good to just, meet people from all over the place with a common interest.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, for me, though, I was so chuffed with this particular podcast because, as I say, I didn't have that much love for the NES console, if I'll be honest, before. But thanks to the games you sort of spending real time with it, I've grown a real appreciation for the console, and it looks like it's going to be yet another console that's going to be sat on the side that I've got to buy now, and my wife will be thrilled.
You're welcome again. You can have that conversation with her. Tell me how it goes. Let me know.
Yeah, I'll say, Alex said. I had to have it.
You could do that. I guess I'm safe over here, right?
Yeah.
There's an ocean between us, right?
You won't
be
safe from my wife, no. She's like the Terminator. Never give up. No, but it's been really good. So, as the guest, Alex, do you want to choose a lead-out song? We often have a song leading out.
Oh, that's right.
Put you on the spot here, yeah. But have you got any thoughts? If you're not sure, then of course the Ninja Gaiden, one of the tunes, is always good.
Actually, why don't we do the very first stage in Batman: Return of the Joker?
Batman Return of the Joker, yes, that's an amazing tune. Okay, guys, well, thanks again to Alex, and thanks for listening. Do please try to give us an iTunes review if you get the chance. It gets our name out there and puts us up the list. And please listen to Retro Game Squad as well. So until, keep it retro and have a good one.